Can we go back now to Genesis 1? And we'll begin with the words in verse 31, where it says that God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. It was very good. Now, in this series, we've been pursuing an understanding of Eden, and we've been looking back to the Eden of Genesis, but we've also been looking forward to the new Eden of the new creation in the book of Revelation and elsewhere in the New Testament. We've seen that God made man. God made man out of the dust. The earth is his home. The dust is his home. God made man in his own image. We've seen how God had man fill the earth, how God gave man a rule over the earth, a good stewardship, so gave him work to do, gave him a day of rest as well, gave him food to eat. We're thinking about all these things. And as I've been preparing these, it struck me that Genesis 1 and 2 are really concerned with the basic human needs of man. That's what they're about. They're not about scientific questions. They're not about answering our curiosity about how God did what he did, but they are telling us something about how God provided for man and answered his basic needs, and they answer the basic questions we have about ourselves and our existence, where we came from, who we are, why we're here, and these kind of questions. I want to think today about beauty. The other day I was standing looking out over Broadford Bay. It was a glorious day. The sea was perfectly calm. In the distance, the Torridon Mountains were shimmering in the heat haze. The air was sweet. The sun was blessing us out of a soft blue sky, a cloudless sky. There were some trees beside me, just gently moving in a breeze. Their foliage fresh and green. Birds were singing. Flowers were blossoming. It was a scene of serene beauty. Except that I was at a funeral. And there was such a large crowd at the funeral that many of us had to stand outside the church, which is what I was doing. Enjoying the beauty of creation, but standing beside the hearse, waiting to receive the coffin containing the cold, still body of a departed, beloved man. And the family, as they left the church with haggard faces, sad, stained with tears. It was a scene of serene beauty and of ugliness at the same time. There was much there to lift the spirit. A beautiful creation and a glorious gospel being preached at the service. But there's nothing more ugly and intrusive and unwelcome as death and all that it brings. That's our human situation today. It's a mixture of beauty and of ugliness. But it wasn't always like that. Genesis begins by bidding us see how God intended things first of all. There was a stage in creation where God did not see the ugliness. It wasn't there. And he could say, as verse 31 says, that it was very good. Creation was all that he wanted it to be. It was beautiful. And there was, as chapter 2 verse 8 says, a garden. Gardens are places that we love because we associate them with beauty. And in that garden, verse 9 of chapter 2 tells us about the trees that were pleasing to the eye. So it was a place of great beauty. But we have to imagine what it was like. because it's long gone. We can't go and visit it. We can work out roughly where this garden was because we're told about some rivers and we know two of them. In verse 14, we know the Tigris and we know the Euphrates. We can probably figure that the Garden of Eden that was described was somewhere in the on the plain of the Tigris-Euphrates in modern Iraq. But, of course, as the story proceeds, man was excluded from the garden. The garden no doubt went wild. It was inundated in the time of the flood. And in Moses' day, by the time we believe the book of Genesis was actually written down as opposed to being oral tradition, the Garden of Eden was merely a memory of somewhere which was, from Moses' perspective, as verse 8 says, in the east. So it was somewhere away in the east, far, far away, somewhere lost. I wonder if you have an imagined picture of it in your mind. What do you see? Is it an orchard? Is it a country estate? Is it a rainforest? Is it some exquisite landscape garden? I don't know. But whatever, we know that it was a feast to the senses, bursting with beauty. But it's not there now. But why did God bother with beauty? I mean, beauty takes a lot of effort. It's much easier to make things functional, much more easy to just make them utilitarian, just make them so that they perform their job. Why didn't God place Adam in a concrete car park? Why didn't God make some kind of goo be exuded out of the concrete in the car park, which was tasteless and odourless and colourless, that Adam could just lick off the concrete and that would have nourished him and kept him going? Why not do that? With the children and Kyle this morning, I had a wee slideshow made up of lots of pictures of concrete things. And we tried to imagine what the world would have been like if God had made it out of concrete. So there was this concrete pillar, and that was a tree, for example, and so on and so forth. We had a bit of fun because the kids hated God's concrete world, and so did I. However, God didn't make the world out of concrete. God made the world beautiful. But why bother? Why all those rich scents in the Garden of Eden, those exquisite shades of colour, the stunning tastes of the fruits there, the melodious bird song, the curves and textures of the garden? And why make us capable of enjoying it? Aesthetic beings. People who have a sense of what is lovely. Well, the reason for that has to be found in God himself. God is not a brutalist, to use the architectural term. He's not someone for whom all that really matters is function. He lives, as we've sung in the Psalms, in the beauty of holiness. And the creation, as we sang, is proclaiming his glory. God is concerned with beauty because he is beautiful. Because he appreciates beauty and he loves to create beauty. God is an artist. At that funeral, we were singing the hymn, How Great Thou Art. And I actually, because I was thinking about this theme at the time, I was actually imagining Adam and Eve walking through Eden, extolling Yahweh, the Creator God, for all the beauty that he had made, using the words of the hymn, when through the woods and forest glades I wander and hear the birds sing sweetly in the trees, when I look down from lofty mountain grandeur and see the brook and feel the gentle breeze, then sings my soul, my Saviour God, to thee, how great thou art, how great thou art. God makes the world beautiful as well as useful. And some things he just makes beautiful. Like in chapter 2 there in verse 12, we're told about gold and aromatic resin and onyx. These are things that really have their usefulness in that they are beautiful. The resin smells good, it's aromatic. The onyx is a beautiful stone. And gold, certainly back in those days, wasn't a practical metal. You couldn't make tools out of it because it was weak. It's not a strong metal. But it's beautiful. God sometimes just makes things because they're beautiful. Not even for any use. God is not then simply concerned with function. He is concerned with beauty, and therefore he expects from us a response of appreciation, of delight, that we should relish the beauty. There have been times in the history of the Christian church where people have almost felt guilty about appreciating beauty, have felt that they couldn't really have beautiful things because that was kind of fleshly and carnal. There are too many dull Christian souls. One of those people that is often thought of as a dull Christian soul is John Calvin, the Reformer. People tend to caricature poor John Calvin as though he was a man who took great pleasure in removing the colour from life. But listen to John Calvin as he writes about Eden. Has the Lord clothed the flowers with the great beauty that greets our eyes, the sweetness of smell that is wafted upon our nostrils? And yet, will it be unlawful for our eyes to be affected by that beauty, or our sense of smell by the sweetness of that odour? What? Did he not so distinguish colours as to make some more lovely than others? What? Did he not endow gold and silver, ivory and marble with a loveliness that renders them more precious than other metals or stones? Did he not, in short, render many things attractive to us apart from their necessary use? So John Calvin's saying, enjoy beauty. Because God made some things just to be beautiful, so that they could be enjoyed. God didn't just make them functional. He didn't make a concrete world. And this theme continues. In chapter 4 of Genesis, at verse 21, we come across a fellow called Jubal, and God has given the gift of music to Jubal. He's the father of those who play the harp and flute. Music is not necessary. I mean, we could get through our lives without music. You don't need music. Music is not some merely functional thing. Music is there for pleasure. Something to beautify and adorn our lives. And it's a gift of God. In the book of Exodus, we come across the making of the tabernacle, and God gives detailed, explicit instructions about that, and gives his spirit in a special anointing to two fellows called Bezalel and Aholiab, who are skilled in all kinds of crafts, working with gold, working with different kinds of fabrics, colourful fabrics. They make the beautiful robes of the priests and of the high priest. They make the furnishings of the tabernacle out of gold, and they make the curtains of the tabernacle out of these fine yarns of scarlet and purple. And the tabernacle had a function in the sacrificial system of Israel, but it was beautiful. It didn't need to be beautiful, but it was. And so why the beauty? Beauty takes effort. We can make things just very plain. But God is not like that, because he himself is beautiful. And beauty in the creation is an expression of his character and what he loves and what he wants us to delight in. Now, unfortunately, we do not live in a uniformly beautiful world. What happened? How was beauty violated? Well, beauty can be a snare. Genesis 3 describes the tree of the knowledge of good and evil as having fruit, which, in verse 6, Eve had a look at, and she saw that it was pleasing to the eye. That's what it says. It was beautiful. And she looked at it and she said, well, God told me I can't have this. But it was beautiful. And she wanted that beauty for herself. But God said, I can't have it. But I want it. And she reached out and she took it for herself. She took that beauty for herself, and the beauty was there violated by her disobedience. And it's a temptation that you and I face daily, that we want beautiful things for ourselves, but they're not meant for us. They're meant for someone else. Or if we're going to get them, we have to go about it in a way that is wrong. And I'm speaking about the kind of attitudes of heart like coveting, like greed, selfishness, stealing, lust, all these things. Simple example, obvious example, is that God made the human body beautiful. And we appreciate that beauty. Men for women, women for men, but if a married person, for example, imagines the beauty of someone else's spouse being in his or her own arms, or indeed goes and makes it happen, they've taken the forbidden fruit. And if we try to possess a forbidden fruit, beautiful though it is, but we try to possess it for ourselves because it is beautiful, we learn what evil is. And ugliness comes into our lives. Remember, it was a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And evil is ugly. I wonder if that's happened in your life. You've seen something and you want it. You want it so much. An advertisement has persuaded you. Or someone else has got one. And you want it, one yourself. And it consumes you. You're prepared to go out of your way to get this thing. You're prepared to do things that you shouldn't do to get this thing for yourself, because it's beautiful. Like that gold and that aromatic resin and that onyx. It's beautiful, but you want it for yourself. And to get it for yourself, you do wrong things. And when you do wrong things, get the beauty you wanted, you get ugliness with it. Sometimes people do that. For example, they don't bother listening to God's rhythm of life, work and rest. They just work. They work all the time. They ignore God's ways, God's rhythm, because they want more. They want to earn money and they want more. And so when they get what they want, they've gone about it in a wrong way and they get ugliness with it. They get evil with it. Our world is saturated with pornography and with imagery that is designed to stimulate lust. And it's a sad world because it takes beauty. And people want that beauty for themselves, so they imagine it, or sometimes they go and try and get it. And instead of getting beauty, they get ugliness in their lives. Killing and stealing and lying and dishonouring parents and coveting, breaking God's law to get beauty. But of course you get the beauty, but you've done something ugly and evil to get it. You get the very opposite of what you wanted in your heart. And people's hearts are full of ugliness today because they try to get things that are beautiful, but they try to get them in a wrong way. And when they get them, they maybe get them and then they get tired of them very quickly and they want something else and they want something else. And all along that discontentment and that coveting is corrupting their hearts and making them more and more ugly. So while they want beauty, they become more and more ugly themselves. We don't want to be like that. Surely what we want in our lives is to be beautiful. The beauty is not beauty of the skin, it's beauty of the heart that we want. How are we going to get that? How are we going to get rid of ugliness? The answer that many people give is art. And we thank God for art, because art can bring beauty into our lives and can bring a lot of relief from the ugliness of life. George Bernard Shaw said, "Without art, the crudeness of reality would make the world unbearable." I have to agree with him to some extent. But the thing is, art, of course, can be part of the problem, because art often is simply a representation of reality in some form or other. It might be abstract, but it's still trying to represent something, and often what it represents is the truth about life, that it's ugly. And much of modern art's like that. I'm not a great fan of modern art, because I think so much of modern art is actually descriptive of the ugliness of life. It's not beautiful. Of course, if it's revealing something about life through art, well, it's been true in a sense, but it just adds to the problem. We've got even more ugliness then. In my thinking, art should make the world beautiful. I came across a quote from a Chaim Potok book where an artist is being reprimanded by his mother. "Why don't you paint pretty pictures like your brother?" she says to the artist. And his answer is, "The world is not a pretty place, mother. Why should I paint lies?" And that's often the thing about art. It's painting the truth, or it's sculpting the truth. But because the truth is often ugly, it just adds ugliness to our lives. And the things that people hang on their walls sometimes. If I'm hanging stuff on the wall, I want it to lift me up. I want it to make me feel better. H.R. Ruckmacher, who wrote a classic book, Christian lecturer in the history of art in Holland somewhere, I can't remember where. He wrote a book called Modern Art and the Death of a Culture. And this is what he says. Beauty, he says, is a byproduct of love, of life in its full sense, of life in love and freedom. The artist with his special gifts has a specific task, a very special and wonderful calling. It's not to play the prophet, nor to be a teacher, nor to be a preacher, nor to evangelize. It is to make life better, more worthwhile, to create the sound, the shape, the tale, the decoration, the environment that is meaningful and lovely and a joy to mankind. And I agree with that. Art is a great help when it seeks to be beautiful. And any of you who have gifts in crafts or gifts in painting or gifts with music or whatever, any of you who make things, don't just make them functional. And don't make them ugly. Seek to make them beautiful. Because the world needs beauty. It needs more beauty, not more ugliness. And if you create beauty, you can help to relieve something of the ugliness of the world. But it only goes so far. You can't remove ugliness by beauty. There's only one way to remove ugliness, and that is through the gospel of Jesus Christ. The gospel of Jesus Christ homes in on the most ugly thing that is conceivable. It homes in on the cross. There is nothing more ugly in human history than people killing the Son of God. And it's butchery, it's execution of the most brutal kind. But it's of a beautiful man. Why do that to this beautiful man? Well, the reason is because God has anointed this beautiful man, Jesus Christ, this righteous man, so that through his death he can remove the ugliness of sin. God has anointed him, as Isaiah 63 says, to give us a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. If there's ugliness in your life today, or in the lives of anyone around you, you may get art and find it helps and relieves things a bit, but it doesn't remove it. The only one who can remove ugliness is Jesus. I said that modern art often is very ugly because it simply observes life, and life is often ugly. Ugly things like the separation of hopeless goodbyes. Ugly things like death, mourning, crying, pain, fear, curse. All of these ugly things belong to our present lives because we make them belong. We sin. We bring the ugliness of evil into our world, and because of that, it can't go on. It's not a permanent situation. God won't let it be permanent. That's why he brings death into our lives, or one of the reasons. Because he's got something better that he wants for us, where there isn't any ugliness. And so Genesis has us look back wistfully at a beauty that is gone. But the gospel has us look forward, hopefully, at a beauty yet to come. Because in the book of Revelation, at the other end of the Bible, you come across the new heavens and the new earth. That is this world renewed. So it's the same physical world, but it's renewed so that the ugliness is gone. And this is described in a symbolic way in the book of Revelation, chapter 21. We're going to sing this passage in a moment. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, John says, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. Now remember, it's symbolic. Of course there will be sea in the new heavens and the new earth, but this is a symbolic description. Sea for the Apostle John. So he looked across from the island of exile he was on, was representative of separation. Sea for the Jewish people was a place of danger, a place of lurking depths of horrors and things that came out from under the sea to threaten you. All of that's gone. There will no more be death, says John, or mourning or crying or pain. For the old order of things has passed away. There will be no night there. Again, it's symbolic. Night is the time when evil lurks and goes about its dark purposes. But there won't be any of that. No longer will there be any curse. You'll find all of this in Revelation 21 and 22. There's no ugliness then. The ugliness is gone. It's beautiful again. But it's even more beautiful in Genesis 1 and 2 because it's a redeemed beauty. It's a beauty that God has restored through his Son, Jesus Christ. So it's not just about God making a beautiful thing. It's about God showing the beauty of his character in restoring something that's ugly and in bringing it to beauty. It's about God showing the power of his gospel, his grace, his forgiveness, his mercy to all who receive Jesus Christ. Ugliness is gone. And there is a beauty that is even greater than the beauty we read about in Eden. And if you want to be part of that beauty, then art won't do it for you. What you need is Jesus. Art may relieve the ugliness, but only Jesus can remove the ugliness. You need to receive him. Only Jesus can cleanse us from all sin. And only Jesus can make us part of that glorious new creation where all is beauty. The beauty of God is a beauty of God's character and of God's creativity and God's richness and God's delight. A creation functioning as it should function, without any ugliness to defile it.